He had been born in a litter at first, while he was unconscious, and then later when he was still too weak to march, so he didn't know for how long and in what direction they'd travelled. Even later, when he was forced to walk, they bound and blindfolded him so that he was aware only of the press of their bodies about him, and the stench of sweat, and the rancid fat with which they smeared their skin. There was no answer when he spoke, and rough hands urged him forward, and a spear blade pricked him when he balked. He had been badly beaten and bruised. There were still lumps and gashes in his scalp, and his body was grazed and painfully wrenched. But he had taken no serious wounds, no deep spear thrust or broken bones. It was as though they had carefully avoided dealing him a killing or crippling injury, despite the fact that he had piled the corpses of their comrades in windrows about him, the vulture axe taking cruel toll before they overwhelmed him. On the first night when they camped, he began a tentative investigation of his position, with escape in mind. But then, when he tried to shift his blindfold enough to see out, a heavy blow in the face dissuaded him. They fed him with a handful of boiled corn and a strip of badly cured meat, gamey and rank with bacon beetle. Hui ate it hungrily. In the morning, they were marching before dawn, and when Hugh felt the sun's warmth on his cheek and saw the light through his blindfold, he repeated the praise of Baal silently and asked the god for his help. Later that day, he was aware of the ground levelling beneath his feet as they journeyed across an open plain, and there was the smell of cow dung and smoke and humanity. Over the thudding rhythm of his escort's bare feet and the swish of their war kilts, he heard a vast susurration of voices and movement. Blending with this was the lowing of many cattle. The air quivered with sound and movement, a hive murmur, which warned him of the presence of a great multitude. At last they stopped him. He stood weary and thirsty in the hot sun, with the rawhide rope cutting into his wrists and his bruises and grazes aching. Time passed slowly in the silence of waiting men. At last a voice called out loudly, and Hui's nerves jumped. The voice was in Vendi, demanding, "Who seeks the lion-clawed? Who seeks the bird-footed?" Hui remained silent, waiting for some indication of how to behave, and to his surprise he felt the cool touch of iron at his wrists, and the blade sawed through his bonds. He rubbed his fingers, wincing at the flow of blood. Then he lifted his hands to the blindfold, expecting another blow, but none came, and he loosened the cloth and blinked uncertainly in the bright sunlight. His eyes adjusted quickly, and he felt his heart lurch with shock at what he saw. Hui stood at the center of a wide plain, a slightly concave bowl of land, rimmed in with low hills. Except for a circular open area 100 paces across, at the center of which Hui now stood, the land was black with warriors. Hui gazed in awe at this multitude, and he couldn't begin to reckon their numbers. He would never have believed that the land could support such numbers. It was unreal, completely nightmarish, and the quality of unreality was heightened by the menacing stillness of the black hordes. Only the feathers of their headdresses stirred in the sluggish wash of heated noonday air. The heat and the press of humanity threatened to suffocate him, and he looked about him desperately as though seeking an avenue of escape. Storch stood near him, and he carried the vulture axe on his shoulder. Hui felt a weak flutter of anger for the man's treachery, but somehow it seemed unimportant in the enormity of this fresh experience. Storch was not looking at him. Instead, he was watching a group of Vendi war captains who stood about a low mound earth at the end of the clearing. The mound was bare, but compelled the attention of them all, like an empty stage before the principals appear. Again the voice demanded, "Who seeks the great black beast? Who hunts the lion?" The heated silence and stillness persisted, and then suddenly the multitude stirred and sighed, as a man stepped up onto the mound. The tall crown of heron feathers on his head and the height of the mound upon which he stood made him godlike. His robes of leopard skin hung to the ground about him, and he stood as still as a tall tree in a rustling plain of grass as the royal salute shook the foundations of earth and sky. Storch carried the vulture axe to the mound and laid it at the king's feet. Then he backed away, and the king looked across the open ground at Hui. Hui drew himself up, trying to ignore the aches of his body, trying not to limp as he approached the mound and looked up at Manatasi. "I should have guessed," he said in Punic.
"You should have killed me," said Manatasi.
And from the folds of his robes he lifted the iron claw,
"instead of arming me with this."
"You do not understand," Hui said. "Your life wasn't mine to take. I made an oath."
"Still a man who lives on his word," Manatasi said.
Yet Hui looked in vain for the traces of mockery in his voice.
"There is no other way to live."
Hui felt tired now. He faced his certain death with resignation. He didn't really have the energy to debate it. Manatasi made a gesture with the claw, indicating the massed ranks of his army.
"You see what a spear I have forged?"
"Yes," Hui nodded.
"Who can stand against me?" Manatasi asked.
"Many will try," said Hui.
"You amongst them?"
And Hui smiled. "I don't think I will have the chance to do so." Manatasi looked down at the little hunchback in his tattered tunic, his beard matted and the bruises on his face and arms, soiled and beaten, but not humble, as he discussed his own fate.
"Not one of my men understands us," Manatasi told Hui. "We can speak freely."
Hui nodded, puzzled but interested in this change of mood.
"I offer you life, Hui Ben Hammon. Come to me. Give me the love and duty you have given to the Grey Lion of Opit, and you will live to be an old man."
"Why do you choose me?" Hui asked.
"I have waited for you. I knew you would come. My spies have watched for you. But it was fate that delivered you so neatly into my hands."
"Why me?" Hui repeated.
"I need you," Manatasi said simply. "I need your learning. I need your understanding. And your humanity."
"You forgive me the taking of your hand?" Hui asked.
"You could have taken my life,"
Manatasi answered. "You forgive the slave Lash and the mines of Hulia?"
"Those I will never forgive,"
Manatasi snarled, his face twitching and his eyes glaring smoky yellow.
"But they were not your doing."
"You forgive the massacre at Set?" Hui persisted.
"You are a soldier. You could do nothing else."
Manatasi was still trembling, and Hui sensed how narrowly he skirted the abyss. But he felt compelled to explore this man's strength and weakness. "What would you have of me, then?" Hui asked.
"March beside me," said Manatasi. "Against?" "Against Opet, and its monstrous cruelties and terrible gods,"
Manatasi urged him.
"With you beside me in this army at my back, I will rule the world."
"I cannot do that." Hui shook his head.
"Why not? Tell me why. It is evil. It must be destroyed."
"It is mine," said Hui. "My hand, my people, my gods. Therefore they cannot be evil."
"I thought you were a man of reason," Manatasi snarled.
"Reason can carry a man just so far. And then he must trust to his heart," said Hui.
"You refuse me, then?"
"Yes."
"You know that you choose death?"
"Yes." Manatasi raised his hand, the iron claw glowing in the sunlight, and Hu knew that when the hand fell, he would die. He steeled himself to meet it, as calmly as he had dealt it. Manatasi turned away, and then after a moment he sighed, and his shoulders beneath the thick scars heaved.
"You spared me," said Manatasi. "I shall spare you."
Hughie felt weak with relief. He hadn't wanted to die, and he allowed himself at last to think of Tanith and the child. Now he would still see his son, and his heart soared.
"Go back to Opet. Go back to your king. Tell him that Manatasi, the great black beast, marches out of the north to destroy him."
"Should you warn an enemy?" Hughie asked. "Did I teach you that?"
Manatasi smiled. "A warning will not help him," he said. "Tell him what you saw here. Tell him of this army, and let it chill his guts. Tell him I come for him, and I will spare none nor leave a memory of him to taint this land. Tell him I come, and I come swiftly."
Manatasi picked up the vulture axe and handed it to Hughie.
"Go," he said. "All debts between us have been paid. You have no call on me, and I have no call upon you. When I meet you again, I shall kill you."
They stared at each other, standing close enough to touch, but separated by a distance wider than the span of the oceans or the vastness of the land. Hughie turned and limped away down the corridor of warriors that opened for him, and no man barred his way.
"Old mother, you must not distress yourself so," Tanith whispered. "It was not your fault." "I would have told them," Aina mumbled. "I know I would have told them. That sister Haka, she terrifies me." "You did not tell," Tanith comforted her. "You kept our secret well. Even we ourselves didn't know you'd found out." Aina set down the food bowl beside Tanith's bed, and she smiled reflectively. "You were so happy, the two of you. It made me feel good just to see you. He's a good person, despite his poor crooked back. He's gentle and kind." Tanith moved across on the couch, making room for Aina to sit. "Sit by me for a while, old mother. I'm so lonely here, it makes the waiting so much harder." Aina glanced fearfully across the narrow chamber at the barred doorway. "They don't like me to stay too long. Please," Tanith entreated. "There is so little time left." And Aina nodded and gathered up her skirts to sit, creaking at her knee joints upon the couch. Tanith leaned close to her, and she whispered eagerly, "Did you send messengers? Did you find someone to go?" "I sent two young ensigns from Legion Ben Ammon. They worship the Holy Father as though he were himself a god. I told them that you were in mortal danger and that the Holy Father must return with all speed." "Do you think they will find him?" "There are 100 roads that he might take, and the land is wide." "I would not lie to you, my child. The chance is not good." "I know," said Tanith. "And if they find him, can you return in time? And if he does, is there aught he can do to dissuade the Grey Lion?" "If he returns in time, then you are safe. I know the man." "Wait for him, Aina. If he returns, go to him secretly and tell him that the king knows about us. You must warn him of that, for he is also in danger." "I will warn him," promised Aina. "Oh, I pray to all the gods that he return swiftly to Opet. I don't want to die, old mother. There is so much I would yet have from life, but the days run out now. It is already the 6th day of the festival. Unless Hughie comes, there are but 4 days of my life left." "Gently, child," Aina crooned, and put an arm about Tanith to pat and cuddle her. "Be brave," she crooned. Be brave, child. It is not so easy, Tanith told her, but I will try. And she pulled away from Aina's embrace and sat up straight. You must go now, old mother, or Haka will beat you again. On the walls of the fortress at Zanat, south of the great river, a sentry held a javelin lightly in his right hand, concealing it below the level of the parapet. And he looked down on the strange, wild figure below him. The man's hair was filthy and matted. He wore no armor. His tunic hung in tatters, and his face was bruised and badly swollen. He seemed to be wounded, for he was doubled up painfully in an unnatural posture, bowed beneath the weight of the huge battle axe he carried. "What is your name, and what is your business?" the sentry hailed, and the traveler looked up at him. "I am Ben Ammon, high priest of Baal and warrior of Opet. My business is the king's." The sentry started and thrust the javelin back into its rack. He realized how close he'd come to making a fool of himself. The crooked back and the axe were famous throughout the four kingdoms. He should have recognized them immediately, and he berated himself as he ran down into the courtyard, shouting for the officer of the guard, warning him of their distinguished caller. Hui came in through the side gate the moment it swung open, and he cut short the military salutes with a curt, "Enough of that nonsense." The officer of the guard was startled at having the legion's beloved ceremonial dismissed in such a cavalier fashion, and he smothered a grin. Coupled with his appearance and his beggar's garb, this story would go to swell the body of legend that already existed about this remarkable little man. Hui was striding past the hastily assembled guard, demanding of the officer as he passed, "Where is the general? Is he here?"
"Yes, my lord. Yes, Holiness. He's in his quarters."
"Praise to Baal," Hui grunted with relief. Hui wolfed a thick cut of cold meat, folded between two corn cakes, and he washed it down with a bowl of red wine, speaking through and around each mouthful of food as he issued his orders. Marmon's scribe dashed off each article, racing to keep up with the flow of Hui's words. Marmon sat on his stool in the corner, his head of silver hair shining like a summer thundercloud, and his handsome face anxious and worried. He could hardly believe what he was hearing, yet he knew better than to doubt the word of Hui Ben Ammon. He realized that he was culpable, that he should have been the one to discover this deadly threat that had grown up so swiftly on their borders. Perhaps he'd spent too much of his time dreaming over his ancient histories. Perhaps he'd grown old and feeble without realizing it. He wondered what retribution there would be from Hui Ben Ammon and the Grey Lion of Opet. Neither of them were men who let failure pass unnoticed. He listened as Hui issued the orders which would place every garrison and every unit on the alert, would mobilize every disbanded legion, would send messengers racing across the land, carrying the scrolls that would place the entire empire on a war footing. Marmon wondered at the courage of a man who could make this battle decision alone, a decision for which he would have to answer to the king and the council of nobles. He might be held responsible for all the losses and damages that would arise when the entire industry and commerce of the nation were suspended. It was a decision upon which his own life might hang, as well as that of Opet. As he watched Hui signing the orders, he doubted that he would have had that much certainty of the rightness of his own actions. He knew he would have sent to Opet for orders, and probably have jeopardized whatever chance there was of survival. For, from what Hui had told him, it was a matter of survival. They were confronted by an enemy so vastly superior in numbers that success lay with the gods. Hui was finished. He signed the last scroll, and the fire went out in him.
It was only then that Marmon realized that the man was exhausted. He staggered slightly, his whole body slumping, and he seemed to shrivel in size under the burden of his weariness. Marmon jumped up from his stool and went to him. Hui brushed off the helping arm and tried to gather his strength in hand again.
"I must leave for Opiate," he said, slurring like a drunkard, and steadying himself against the corner of the table. "What day is it, Marmon? I seem to have lost count of the days." "It is the seventh day of the festival, Holiness."
"The festival?" Hui looked at him stupidly.
"The fruitful earth," Marmon reminded him.
"Ah," Hui nodded.
"I didn't think it was that late.
Have you a war elephant to carry me to Opiate?"
"Nay, Holiness," Marmon told him regretfully. "There are no elephants here." "Then I must march," Hui resigned himself. "You must rest first."
"Yes, yes," Hui agreed. "Yes, I must rest." And he let Marmon lead him to the bedchamber. As he fell across the couch, he asked, "How long will it take to reach Opiate from here, Marmon?"
"If you move fast, 6 days. 5 if you fly."
"I shall fly," said Hui. "Wake me at dusk." And he fell asleep. Looking down on the sleeping figure, Marmon felt the familiar stirring of his affections. He felt his admiration for the great heart of this little fighting man. He felt envy for the thrust and drive which always carried him ahead of the pack. And he was glad that Hui Ben Ammon led them at a time of such crisis. It was then he remembered the messenger from Opiate, the young ensign of Legion Ben Ammon, who had passed through the garrison the previous day, carrying an urgent message for the high priest. He debated with himself for a moment and then decided not to disturb Hui's rest. He would tell him when he woke at dusk. At dusk, Hui woke, ate a light meal and oiled his body. 20 minutes later, he ran out into the cool of the evening through the garrison gate with 15 legionaries as escort, and it was only after they'd disappeared into the dark and silent forests of the south that Marmon again remembered the message the young ensign had given him. He thought to send a messenger after Hui, but he knew that no runner of his could hope to catch the priest after he had such a head start. The speed of Hui's long legs were part of the legend. Marmon thought comfortably, "He'll be in Opiate soon enough." And he paced along the parapet until he reached the far end of the fortress. He stayed there until after darkness had fallen, staring into the turbulent north and wondering how soon they would come.